Well, good evening, everyone. It's nice to see a number of black squares again. Maybe some faces will pop up here as we get going. So I hope what we discover and what we chat about this evening will be as interesting for you as it was for me. And before we begin, I must confess that I'm not a scientist. I'm not a molecular biologist. I've done my best with the limited resources which I have available to me to try and cross-check this information to deliver to you that it's as accurate as I'm able to determine it to be. I encourage you to spend your own time to look into these things. They're absolutely fascinating, absolutely astonishing. So hopefully we just whet your appetite tonight. So according to the media, according to the mainstream media, the theory of intelligent design is a faith-based idea. And in saying that, they try to dismiss it. Or the goal by describing it as a faith-based theory is in order to dismiss it as something that has no basis in science. But in fact, the media has confused a fundamental issue. And they are confusing the evidence for the theory with the implications of the theory. So the implications of the theory of intelligent design may certainly lead one to theistic belief or faith. But the theory itself is not based upon theology or faith. It is in fact based upon scientific discovery, which is relatively recent, within the last 70 years or so, kind of in the 50s and 60s. So relatively old as far as science goes, relatively old discoveries, with the discovery of digital code in DNA, the discovery of molecular machines, tiny molecular machines within our bodies. It's based on the fine tuning of the natural laws of the universe and of physics. And this is a very, very critical distinction to make. And the media, of course, wants to dismiss it, wants it to be completely nonsense. So we need to make that connection that this theory of intelligent design is based upon science first, with implications of the information which is revealed leading to then faith or theology. So the concept of design itself in nature is in fact not a foreign one at all. The father of the evolutionary theory, Charles Darwin, the father of the evolutionary theory, Charles Darwin, sought to explain this phenomenon of what appeared to be design in the world all around him. That's essentially his life's work. His legacy in a nutshell what he sought to do was to explain the appearance of design in nature as just that, an appearance. When in fact he believed that it was entirely undirected, it was entirely natural processes which led to this appearance of design, as opposed to an actual designer directing the way things were to go. Everything in nature mimics design, but it is entirely unguided, is what Charles Darwin would suggest. So many 19th century biologists, and I'm sure humans of all vocations across all of time, were and have been and continue to be impressed and to be fascinated by animals and their particular adaptation to their environment. For example, we have fish, and fish live in water, and fish have gills and fins, and they are perfectly suited to living underwater. I'm not quite as well suited to living underwater as a fish, as you can well imagine. Birds live in the air. They're extremely light. They have wings. They have feathers. They're perfect for flying, and they're perfectly suited to their environment. I'm also not particularly well suited to flying. It'd be great, but the truth is I'm not. Animals that live in cold climates up in the Arctic, for example, have thick fur. They have blubber. They have elements which perfectly suit them to live in the environment in which they live. And the list goes on. And so this has been an area of fascination and interest for biologists particularly. But as I mentioned, I'm sure every person in all of history has marveled at the the particularly well adaptedness of all creatures that they've come across. So let's take a moment, and I'd like you to follow this thought experiment with me. So suppose that we live in northern Scotland, in a very inhospitable part of the world, and suppose that we are shepherds. So it's a cold climate near the ocean with high humidity, which just chills you right to the bone. I think we understand maybe a small part of that here in Victoria. So we have our flock of sheep, and we notice that some of these sheep have actually kind of thicker, denser wool. And so being in such a cold climate, we decide that it would be a great idea if we bred those thick, woolly sheep together to try and increase the overall, you know, wool density of our whole herd. So if we push the thinner wooled sheep to one side and we work only with the thick wooled sheep, that eventually we'll have, and our entire herd will be of this kind of thicker wooled sheep. And by doing this, by deliberately doing this, by implementing these breeding procedures, we can actually change the characteristics of our whole flock into these very well-suited sheep, which have really thick, nice wool coats to keep them warm in this very inhospitable climate of northern Scotland where we live. Now, this isn't a stretch of the imagination. This is human intervention. This is what breeders have done for as long as husbandry has existed itself. They're always trying to get the best characteristics and pass those on into the rest of their livestock for obvious reasons. So suppose now for a moment that we're actually lazy shepherds in Scotland and we're much more interested in Scotch than in sheep. And suppose that there's a series of extremely severe winters, so severe, in fact, that all but the wooliest of our flock dies. The winters are just so hard that the thin wooled sheep just die off, and it's only the woolly ones which actually even survive. So in the same way, the characteristics of our flock would also be altered, but it would have nothing to do with us. It would have nothing to do with our direction, our manipulation, our breeding practices, and so on. And essentially, this is what Darwin proposed. And essentially, this is the fundamental characteristic of the theory of evolution. That entirely natural and undirected processes produced these particular well-suitedness characteristics in animals for their environments. And so these biologists in the 19th century would observe these things, and then Darwin comes along with his theory, and they would see it as proof in the pudding that each of these species is so perfectly suited to where it lives that this must be the case. Now, this theory holds up all right, as long as you consider that you started with sheep in the first place. But what happens before you have sheep altogether, let alone wool? What happens before you have any life at all on this planet? This observation of adaption may provide a satisfactory explanation for some, but the variety of the species which we see on our planet today, it in no way explains the intricacy of the level of variety we have in the species which we see around us. Even Darwin theorized, or everything Darwin theorized, assumed the existence of life already in order to have something to naturally select from. And for the rest of the 19th century, biologists around him, as they considered this new theory, the problem of first life actually didn't pose much of a problem for them, as their understanding of what a cell was to begin with was, of course, extremely limited. And their idea of what a cell was very, very oversimplified. And some of the scientists or biologists around the turn of the century described a cell as a single homogeneous blob of plasm, undifferentiated plasm or protoplasm, just like a tiny little blob of jello. And that's what a cell was. So if your understanding of a cell is just a little blob of jello, It's not a great stretch to assume that just a little chemical reaction could produce a cell. And so there wasn't a strong push per se to really go further and to say, well, how did this all start to begin with? Because it didn't seem like a big deal for many of these biologists. They just thought, well, you know, it's just a few chemical reactions and then a little blob of plasm comes up and that's a cell. And then it divides and divides and divides. And then we are where we are today. So this sort of theory and this kind of just glossing over of the problem of the actual origin of life itself continued until around the 50s or 60s, until what molecular biologists call the molecular biological revolution. And that came with James Watson and Francis Crick, who discovered or rather elucidated the structure of the DNA molecule, which I'm sure we've all heard a lot about, this beautiful double helix structure. So DNA, for those who don't know, which I assume is probably a small number of us, is the information molecule found inside the nucleus of every cell. It is in the shape of a double spiral helix with two spines on the outside. And towards the middle of this double helix strand, there are bases containing one of four different codes or characters. And the sequence, the particular sequence and order of these bases contains an unfathomable amount of information on its approximately 3 meter length. If you were to unravel a tiny strand of DNA, it would be about 3 meters long and about 2 nanometers wide, which is very small, very small. So what may be actually more important than the discovery of DNA itself was what Francis Crick elucidated a few years later, 3 or 4 years later, in his sequence hypothesis. So along the spines, the two spines that spin around in the DNA molecule, there's four chemical subunits, and they're called bases. And they function this very similar, almost the same as what our alphabet would do, except there's only four instead of we have 26 in our alphabet. So these four bases are virtually identical. They are identical to a digital code, and they are essentially like a language. So like a computer code. And so what biologists began to realize with this revelation is that the problem of original life suddenly became an absolutely monumental one. Threatening, well, at least for the honest ones, threatening the entire foundation of Darwin's theory of evolution. Not only was the cell not an undifferentiated blob of plasm or jello, it turned out to be something so much more complicated than they could ever imagine, so much more intricate. And so, of course, this opens up a whole new world of questions. So this is fascinating. It's not just the particular shape or the arrangement of the molecules in DNA. Rather, it's the very specific sequence, the very order, the organized sequence and order of these bases, of these four different bases, which allow the DNA to perform its function. And what Crick anticipated is that this specific sequence of the molecular bases provided instructions for the construction of the critical proteins and the protein machines, which keeps the cell alive. Now, proteins, and we'll talk a little bit about this in a minute, proteins are the toolbox of a cell. So if you imagine a cell, proteins are, there's tons and tons of proteins inside a cell, and they are the tools which allow the cell to, for example, to move, to eat, to do whatever that particular cell does. The proteins are the tools within that cell. They have a huge, huge variety of functions. They process information. They form structures, the actual structure of the cell. They transport materials, for example, like hemoglobin molecules or proteins transfer oxygen in blood. So they provide a whole host of functions based specifically on their actual physical, the shape of these proteins is what allows them to do their job and to complete their function. So take, for example, a hammer. Imagine a hammer. Now, hammer is quite a specific tool, relatively speaking, and it's suited to its job based on its particular characteristics. So imagine a hammer without a head on the top of it, just a stick. Well, it's not going to be as nearly as effective. It might be completely useless at all, depending what you're trying to do, if there's no head on it. Imagine if your hammer is made out of styrofoam. There's no weight to it all. It's fragile. It's brittle. It'll just break as soon as you try and hammer something. Now, on the flip side, imagine you have a problem that you need to solve, which is a nail, which you need to drive into a piece of wood. Now, if you need a specific tool to do that job, you need a specific tool to do that job. You can't use a tape measure, for example, to pound in a nail. You can't use a saw. You can't use a glove. So all of these different proteins and protein machines have to be just so. They have to be perfectly suited in order and perfectly built and constructed in order to fulfill the job that they have to do, the function within the cell, to help the cell to survive, to live. So we have a little video I'd like to show you now. I think it's about six or seven minutes. I'm not sure how well this is going to work. We'll give it a go. Hopefully it's not too jerky. Hopefully the video comes through relatively smoothly, and hopefully you can hear it as well. It's really, really quite astonishing. So let's see if this will work. Can anybody see my screen? Matt, how are we looking?
Yep, we can see it.
Perfect.
Proteins play countless roles throughout the biological world. Some transport nutrients throughout the body. Some help chemical reactions to happen at faster rates. Others build the structures that make up living things. Despite this wide range of functions, all proteins are made out of the same 21 building blocks, called amino acids. Amino acids are made of carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, and hydrogen atoms, and some contain sulfur atoms. Selenocysteine is the only standard amino acid that contains a selenium atom. These atoms form an amino group, a carboxyl group, and a side chain, all attached to a central carbon atom. The side chain determines an amino acid's properties and is the only part that varies from amino acid to amino acid. Hydrophobic amino acids have carbon-rich side chains, which don't interact well with water. Hydrophilic or polar amino acids interact well with water. Charged amino acids interact with oppositely charged amino acids or with other molecules. Primary structure. The primary structure of a protein is the linear sequence of amino acids as encoded by DNA. The amino acids in a protein are joined by peptide bonds, which link the amino group of one amino acid to the carboxyl group of another. A water molecule is released each time a peptide bond is formed. This linked series of carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen atoms is the protein backbone. Protein chains often fold into two types of secondary structures, alpha helices and beta sheets. An alpha helix is a right-handed coil stabilized by hydrogen bonds between the amine and carboxyl groups of nearby amino acids. Beta sheets are formed when hydrogen bonds stabilize two or more adjacent strands of amino acids. The tertiary structure of a protein is the three-dimensional shape of the protein chain. This shape is determined by the characteristics of the amino acids making up the chain. Many proteins form globular shapes with hydrophobic side chains sheltered on the inside, away from surrounding water molecules. Membrane-bound proteins have hydrophobic amino acids clustered together on their exteriors, so that hydrophobic side chains can interact with the lipids in the membrane. Charged amino acids allow proteins to interact with molecules that have complementary charges. functions of many proteins rely upon their three-dimensional shapes. For example, hemoglobin forms a pocket to hold heme, a small molecule with an iron atom in the center that binds to oxygen. Quaternary structure. Two or more polypeptide chains can come together to form one functional molecule with several subunits. The four subunits of hemoglobin cooperate so the complex can more easily pick up oxygen in the lungs and release it in the body. Different visual representations of proteins can give us visual clues about protein structure and function. This space-filling diagram shows all of the atoms that make up this protein. This representation, called a ribbon or cartoon diagram, shows the organization of the protein backbone and highlights alpha helices. This surface representation shows the areas in the protein that are accessible to water molecules. Most proteins are smaller than the wavelength of light. For example, the hemoglobin molecule is about 6.5 nanometers in size. Hemoglobin is found in high concentration in red blood cells. A typical red blood cell contains about 280 million hemoglobin molecules. The three-dimensional shapes of proteins determine their function. The flexible arms of antibodies protect us from disease by recognizing and binding to pathogens and targeting them for destruction by the immune system. The hormone insulin is a small stable protein that can easily maintain its shape while traveling through the blood to regulate blood glucose level. Alpha amylase is an enzyme that begins digestion of starches in our saliva. Calcium pump is aided by magnesium and powered by ATP to move calcium ions back to the sarcoplasmic reticulum after each muscle contraction. Ferritin is a spherical protein with channels that allow iron atoms to enter and exit depending upon an organism's needs. On the inside, ferritin forms a hollow space with iron atoms attached to the inner wall. Ferritin stores iron in a non-toxic form. Collagen forms a strong triple helix that is used throughout the body for structural support. Collagen molecules can form elongated fibrils, which aggregate to form collagen fibers. This type of collagen is abundant in skin and tendons. Learn more about the functions and 3D structures of proteins and other molecular machines at the RCSB Protein Data Bank.
So, I hope that made some sense. I know there was a few things in there which I found that were kind of beyond me, but I can send anyone the link to that video, and of course there's so many more. But it's staggering the level of complexity in such a tiny package. We're talking about just like molecules and atoms and so on. All these things are going on within our bodies like all the time. It's just really, really incredibly remarkable. So I'm not sure if any of you noticed or picked up when they were talking about hemoglobin. I'm not sure how well the video came across or the sound or the audio. But hemoglobin is, as I'm sure many of us know, is a protein which attracts oxygen in the lungs and disperses it to cells throughout the body in the bloodstream. It's what makes our blood red, actually. So the typical human hemoglobin molecule comprises four subunits. I'm not sure if you noticed that or remember that from the little video. So there's four subunits, in hemoglobin, two alpha chains and two beta chains. And each of those alpha chains contains 141 amino acids. And each of the beta chains contains 146 amino acids. So with simple math, that tells us that in one hemoglobin molecule, there are 574 individual amino acids required to be in perfect order, in perfect alignment, in order to fold and you know, form up into that particular shape, which is what is critical for it to be able to absorb the oxygen and then to release the oxygen later on. So I've got another little demonstration. Hopefully this again isn't too clunky. So I'm going to try share my screen again. Is that coming up a whiteboard? Does that look right for people?
Yep, looks great, Pete.
Okay, so just give me a second. Need to be able to see my notes. Okay, so what I've got here are Scrabble letters. And I've gone through and I've just picked out, I'm not sure if you can see them here on the table, I picked out 26, which is the number of letters in our alphabet. And what I'll do is I'm going to remove Z, I'm going to remove Q, maybe X. So that takes us down to 23 instead of 26, which is a little closer to what they mentioned of around 20. He said there was 21 different amino acids, which they mentioned there. I've read some places it says 20. So all of the proteins in our body are constructed with from a pool of these 20 or 21 amino acids. So I'm just going to take these letters and I'm going to chuck them here in the bag and I'm going to pull them out one by one. And we're going to see if we can make sense at all of any, if we would be able in any way to make any sort of protein. Now, some of the proteins, like I think they mentioned, some of the hormones are smaller, maybe around 20, only 20 amino acids in a chain to make up a hormone. Hemoglobin, like we just talked about, has, well, four subcomponents with 141 and 146 in a chain. We're not going to try and get 146. What we'll do, and we'll see if this works. I'm just going to type here a little sentence. Okay, let's show up. It's pretty quiet out there. Can you all see that?
Yep, we can see it.
Okay, perfect. So this is 46 letters, not counting spaces or punctuation. So it's 46 letters here. So if we take out, we'll try 46 letters and let's see if we can make any sense of this at all. Okay, so I'm going to reach into the bag and I'm going to pull out S, put it back in. Oh, S did not come up. There it is. V. S again. P. N. Okay, I'm going to just do a space so I can count easier. D. W. U. P. O. C. How long do I need to keep doing this for? Y. Oh, that was Y again. Didn't shuffle good enough. Jay. You. Anyway, maybe I won't go beyond 20 because I think we're starting to see a pretty obvious pattern here. Well, the fact that there's actually no pattern at all is maybe the pattern. So as you can see with just, we'll do 20 letters here. It looks like we managed to get two as a word. But there's absolutely no meaning whatsoever in this string of characters. There's no function at all. It is absolutely entirely useless. So with random chance to try and organize a string of amino acids, or in our case, letters, to produce anything of any value that makes any sense at all, is ridiculous. So I'll stop this again. All right. So if we imagine for a minute that we have a bike lock, and our bike lock has four little wheels on it with the numbers 1 to 10 to lock our bike. So how many possibilities are there? How many possible codes are there on a little four-wheel little bike lock with 10 numbers? Anybody have a quick guess if you want to jump on? Maybe it's too hard to unmute yourselves. Any quick guesses? 1,000. Perfect. I'm not sure that was. I heard a 10,000. That's absolutely perfect. So you have 10,000 possible combinations on a four little wheel bike lock. Now, say your bike lock actually had 10 numbers, 10 little wheels. Does anyone want to guess how many possible combinations there are with 10 wheels on your bike lock? It's 10 trillion. 10 trillion. Awesome. Thank you. I think that sounds like Jeff. So there's 10 trillion potential combos with 10 little wheels on your bike lock. So as we talked about with our proteins, imagine just a modest length protein, not anywhere near as large as hemoglobin. Let's say 150 amino acids, which is a relatively modest, apparently some of the amino acids can have significantly more, hundreds of amino acids in their chain. So if we take a protein with 150 sequence amino acids, there's 20 possibilities at every single one of those 150 sites along that chain. That works out to be 10 to the power of 195 potential proteins in order to get one that actually works. Now that's a staggering, an absolutely staggering number. It would take a fair amount of time to crack that bike lock. To be honest, I don't think that number actually doesn't really mean anything to me. It's so vast. So maybe this will help to put it in perspective. So there are only 10 to the 80th power elementary particles in the entire universe. So think of how vast the universe is and how many particles, like off the periodic table of the elements of atoms, how many of those particles there are. They're estimated to be 10 to the 80th power. Well, the number of combinations to get your modest length of protein is 10 to that 195th. Another thing, if you believe that the universe is 13 or 14 billion years old, since the Big Bang, till now, there has only been 10 to the power of 17 seconds in 14 billion years. So to have a number, a probability with a number of 10 to the 195th power is, it's mind blowing. It's absolutely astonishing. The improbability of random chance producing even one moderately sized protein. Random chance is really actually the worst possible guess you could have for how that protein came to be. So if we start with our primordial bowl of soup. Now let's assume with our bowl of soup that we'll assume the impossibly small chance of a planet like ours even existing in the first place. We'll just assume that that's happened. We'll assume the impossible chance of a planet like ours being perfectly positioned in relationship to its perfect star with a perfectly sized moon, the perfect distance away from the planet, both of which have perfectly shaped orbits. We'll assume that a planet with an impossible amount of water exists, a planet with a liquid molten core, a magnetic field, and an atmosphere to protect it from cosmic radiation, a planet with the perfect elemental makeup in a solar system, which has perfectly placed gas giant planets to absorb the brunt of meteors. We'll assume that this solar system is perfectly placed within its galaxy. We'll assume that all that exists and is all true. Because of course, if just one of those things we mentioned was off, just one of those things was off, none of this would exist. There would be no primordial soup to even think about to begin with. So we'll go back to our bowl of soup, which we are going to allow that it even exists in the first place. Now, we need carbon atoms. If you remember from the video, we need carbon atoms, oxygen, nitrogen, hydrogen, and a few bits of sulfur. So then we need those random elements for no reason at all to decide to bond together in exactly the perfect arrangement and alignment to form an amino acid. And not just one amino acid, we actually need 20 or 21 unique amino acids to just randomly join together for no reason. And then we take these random amino acids, which have no reason to exist at all in this bowl of soup, and then somehow they need to, again, for no reason, they need to join together in a very, very specific arrangement, sometimes hundreds of amino acids long. So let's say all that happens, and then we end up with a protein. But the protein itself is still useless. It needs a whole host of other proteins, all going through these staggeringly impossible odds of forming together. And all these random proteins need to organize themselves to have any sort of usefulness. So it's estimated that there are some 42 million proteins in one single-celled organism. And there's anywhere from 80 up to 400,000 unique proteins in the human body. So this begs the question then, who has more faith? He who believes in a level of complexity, in this level of complexity appearing by accident, or he who believes in a designer? So now, maybe, if possible, even more remarkable than the staggering improbability of the chemistry to come up with all these amino acids and proteins is the existence within cells of digital code in every cell of DNA. And the information contained in a single strand of DNA is so remarkable, it makes all these other probabilities look like our little four-digit bike lock by comparison. So how did this incredibly complex and precise instruction manual end up inside all these cells? Where did it come from? Charles Darwin, with one of his colleagues, also left us another theory. And it was a theory of how you were to determine and how you were to understand events in the recent, or sorry, events in the in ancient history, how you to try and determine how they came to be, the causal effects. And what Darwin and his colleague came up with is the best way to figure out what happened in ancient times is to look at current times in things which you can now readily observe, which produce the same effect. So, for example, we're digging down in our backyard a few hundred feet, and we come across a layer of ash in all the layers of soil that we're digging down. We come across this layer of ash. So we might think to ourselves, how did that ash get there? We could think, well, maybe it was from an earthquake. Maybe an earthquake made all this ash, or maybe it was a flood that made all this ash, or it could have been maybe it was an avalanche, or maybe it was a fire, or maybe it was a volcano. So we look around the world today now with what we can observe and try and determine what we know for certain now from things that we can observe, what would produce a layer of ash. Well, we can rule out flood, obviously. We can rule out earthquake. We can rule out avalanche. Maybe fire, but our layer of ash is this thick. So we'd probably rule out fire. Well, then we come to volcano and okay, that makes sense. A volcano could create this phenomenon. We can observe it now. And so we can assume then that when we, in ancient history, the same forces were at work and that there was a volcano at some point which laid down this layer of ash. So if we apply this same model, the same model that Charles Darwin and his colleague implemented, what do we know of today for certain that we can observe? What do we know of today which can create digital code, computer code, a written language? What do we know of today? What are some forces that we're aware of which can create language and written language? Well, the answer is obvious. It's a mind. It's an intelligence. It's a human intelligence for these particular things. So you see, friends, the basis for the theory of intelligent design is scientific study. But the implications of this theory are certainly theistic. So there's a reason I decided to forego a scripture reading at the beginning of this class. God's stamp is so evident throughout all of his design that we can see him clearly, even without his written word. Paul says in his letter to the Romans in chapter 1 and verse 20, he says, "For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made." They weren't even looking at DNA or cells. And they still came up to this conclusion. So they're without excuse, Paul says. When we consider the astonishing complexity of the design of the world around us, we too are without excuse. Beyond the wonders of the natural world, God has preserved for us his written word so that we might come to know not just that he exists, but his plan and his purpose with the earth and how we might become a part of it. So we'll finish with a reading now at the end of the class. We'll read from Psalm 139. This is a Psalm of David. And he says, Psalm 139, "O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest my down sitting and mine uprising. Thou understandest my thought afar off. Thou compassest my path and my lying down and art acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. Thou hast beset me behind and before and laid thine hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain unto it. Whither shall I go from thy spirit? Or whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend up into heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there shall thy hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light about me. Yea, the darkness hideth not from thee, and the night shineth as the day. The darkness and light are both alike to thee. For thou hast possessed my reins, thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. David didn't even know about DNA or any of these kind of things that we can see now, and yet he was able to say with confidence that he was fearfully and wonderfully made. And how true is that?